Today on Inland Journal, we've spent two programs during the last month talking with the candidates for Spokane mayor, and now we talk with the man they're hoping to replace. With 5 months to go in his administration, David Condon is still moving ahead on a variety of issues, including homelessness. For example, the city is planning to buy a building to renovate for a homeless shelter in East Spokane, near the city's border with Spokane Valley. But we asked the mayor about something else, a city proposal to create its own facilities to handle people charged with misdemeanor crimes.
Now, the city has a municipal bench. These are programs that we've run. It got quite a bit of notoriety in the downtown library. We run community court. We have other programs that we run at the municipal level. And so as part of an integrated solution, we are looking at, should the city take the lead in a integrated approach to misdemeanors? And so let's just for a moment think about a hospital. Would you design an entire hospital at the level of what, say, an ICU or a trauma unit would be? No, because, of course, you have outpatient services, you have day surgery. So that's very similar in the sense of a criminal justice system. People often quickly say, should we build a jail, should we not build a jail? Jail, in its traditional definition, is for more serious crimes. And so you build it differently. You have intake differently. The cells look differently. The programming looks different. And then you have misdemeanors, maybe a first-time misdemeanor, and what do you do with that person? Do we look at more wraparound services like GED completion, like drug and alcohol? And also the facility looks quite a bit different. I went on a tour of one in Hillsboro, Oregon, where quite frankly it looked like a dorm. It had pods, the chimes would go off from time to time, and people would have to stand behind a color on the carpet, and so that they could get a quick count of where everybody is. But besides that, they were pretty open, free. You know, they wore more civilian-style clothes. They weren't in jumpsuits, that sort of thing. They attended classes and work sources. And so, yes, it was, in an essence, a controlled environment. Let's not forget that. But much more, you know, interactive in those wraparound services. And so when we say the city's going alone, no. The city has full jurisdiction over misdemeanor crime. And how do we deal with that in a criminal justice reform? And so my pledge is that that would be integrated. So what does that mean? That means that perhaps the other cities would come together and the city government of Spokane would come together, and you might have something similar to, dare I say, Shrek, where you would have a public development authority that would have, yes, it would have people from the city of Spokane, but maybe the valley, the county, and we would focus on a facility that would be those low-level crime, and then it would really then allow us to look at a long-term solution for long-term confinement or jail that we all traditionally think about, and not have the cost burden for misdemeanors that a full-scale, full-security jail would be. And I think we need a new facility. That's quite, you know, for our, you know, what I would call our maximum jail kind of security. And I don't want to say, you know, like what the state takes care of or the federal government takes care of. But so this is a work group that is focused on what the city has authority over. And it would be our prerogative that that would be an integrated solution. We wouldn't only be City of Spokane misdemeanors. It's much more effective if we take it on. Is the city taking the lead? Absolutely, which is fine. This is an area that is our responsibility. But what it really does allow then, which is the responsibility of the county government, the city, Superior Court bench, is more what you would see as a tradition. You know, several years ago, I remember Sheriff Ozzy Knezovich and then director of the jail coming, and they showed a graphic that showed different blocks, almost like Legos. And so you would have a high security, a low security, some of the what you would call daytime security, where people have classes, they check in, maybe do drug testing. And so this is just one of those building blocks. But taking it to the next level and then taking some leadership on it, realizing that the city, this is where you see a lot of the property crime things, and so we really need to get our arms around that, and we've stepped up the enforcement, more police officers, but we've noticed as you go through the system that now one of our opportunities for improvement is in the confinement space and what you do there in the rehabilitation area. And so that's why we said, yes, you know, actually adding more police officers, probably at this point won't facilitate it. This is where you get these, you know, these stories of someone being arrested 14, 15, 16, 20 times. Well, it really then comes to, well, we need to focus on the rehabilitation portion of this. And that's why you've seen the city now, you know, kind of pivot to that, saying, how can we be a convener in looking at what is the rehabilitation piece of this? Because quite frankly, you know, adding more on the enforcement side isn't going to do demonstratively more. We need to get people rehabilitated, because yet adding another arrest to their litany of arrests isn't going to facilitate, you know, solving this problem. We really need to focus on the rehabilitation problem. Staying constant with the enforcement, don't get me wrong, but, you know, now we really need to pivot towards the rehabilitation side.
So analyzing the costs, how does this work out for the city is to compare to what you're doing right now and spending in terms of municipal court and all that?
There's two pieces of this. You know, there's direct costs that city government has, right? The cost of judges and bailiffs and parole. And then separate from that is the cost, and with that also is confining somebody on a misdemeanor, which is very rare, to be honest with you. That's why you see these kind of book and release sort of things. But even that is quite expensive. And so rather than, you know, again, building the maximum security for something that's really a low security need, the maximum security intrinsically is more expensive. And so there's no reason to do the capacity for all the misdemeanors on the very expensive route. What's a different route that's less expensive? And so we believe we have the money internally to do that as we relook that. Not only that, but as you look at the facilities, we have detectives separate from prosecutors, separate from defenders. And so the city owns a few facilities. And so would we surplus those and use that to then build a new integrated facility? That is what we're in the works of now. Before we would ever go to the public to say we need to raise even more money, how can we utilize the facilities we have now? You know, presumably we look at some modeling of on the program side. If you integrated these programs, could we have some cost savings there also?
So we know that your city administrator has been talking with the county about that. What's been the reception on the other end?
Well, you know, the issue is, you know, initially the sheriff, I think, misunderstood the idea that this is backing away from, you know, a jail. No. The issue is we have a body of work, of programs, that we need to have more integrated. On the maximum security side, you do too also. But again, it goes back to that original graphic that he showed some 10, 15 years ago that showed these different building blocks. This is yet one of those building blocks, the yellow one or the green one that is on that diagram. And so I think, you know, people get very excited about the idea of integration. They get very excited about investment in more in facilities that are more supportive of the programs we do today. You know, as we look at this and as the community for the last 5 or 6 years has been focusing on the criminal justice reform, we really see some expertise in integration. And frankly, the co-location of different services facilitates integration. Much easier to go back to your cubicle in a different building and not work with the people, you know, that might be a quarter mile away. When you're in the same facility, and so on the staff side, it facilitates. It doesn't necessarily guarantee it, but it definitely facilitates it. And then on the client side, both from the victim and from the side of the accused, that it really facilitates this. You'll see pockets of excellence in this. We have the domestic violence unit, where we have, you know, it's actually located really for the client's perspective, especially for the victim. Amazing partnership with YWCA, so it's not like you're going to the jail to get services. You're going to the YWCA, but our detectives are there, both the county and the city detectives. The prosecutors are there. The client advocates are there. But not only that, you've got daycare. You also have a clothing bank. You have other things, so that if you're suffering from domestic violence or surviving domestic violence, and you know you're trying to, you have a child, or you know, all those services are there, and you see great benefits out of that. And the co-location matters from the client's perspective, from the staff perspective. And so we have integration there. You know, you see it when we did community court. All, you know, the public defender and the prosecutor, two different positions, obviously the prosecutor, but they come to an agreement that, you know, for the client's perspective and for the victim's perspective, this is a better way of doing it. And not only that, but all of our social services are there. Imagine if that community court activity happened in this facility. You know, there we have it in the library currently, but, you know, where's a permanent location to where, you know, some Monday afternoons, there's upwards of a couple dozen social service providers that can, that the judge can order the accused to and say, you know what, you need to go get a social security number. You need to go and get drug and alcohol counseling. And oh, by the way, those services are next door in the next conference room. So it's taking that same idea for a municipal criminal justice center, but focusing on misdemeanors, not on, you know, more severe crimes, murder and other, you know, crimes that are in front of the superior court, which really is the traditional jail. And I think that's where, unfortunately, you know, a lot of the confusion is saying it's not yes jail, no jail. And I think a lot of our social justice folks are really focusing on, you know, this misdemeanor idea and, you know, what can we do there? But unfortunately, it gets roped into the city's going to do its own jail. Well, no, the definition is much broader than that. It's a criminal justice system with different facilities that meet the needs of the victims and of the criminals. But and that's where I think and having more of a campus idea versus a single facility meets everybody's needs, because that's just not a reality.
So I was going to ask that. You just mentioned the word campus. What sort of physical facility would you need? Is it one building? Is it several buildings? Have you envisioned that?
You know, they're just starting that, and I'd let the experts decide that. It's generally perspective. It's a facility, again, for misdemeanors, and I think that would be a separate facility, but perhaps because in proximity makes sense. Maybe it doesn't. You know, if there's no interaction between the two, then you don't need to worry about that. But that's what, you know, these are very detailed. These are multi-million-dollar decisions, and so a systems approach is the only way you can do that. You know, there is a lot of need to have a traditional, you know, high security jail next to the superior courts, because there's a lot of expense and a lot of needs there. Now, that's not the case of the missile bench, you know, and what do you need there? And a lot of those people are not in pretrial confinement. And so what does that look like? And do you do home monitoring? You know, we're even doing some pilots in texting people to remind them that they have a court date the next day. And so how is that working? It is working, to be frank with you, in these pilot programs. But, you know, texting for someone that's, you know, accused of a superior court level crime doesn't matter, because they're in pretrial confinement. And so you have different set of systems approaches there. And how can you expedite that? Because a lot of the folks that are in our jail are pre-trial. But at the same time, in our country, there's the rights of the accused. And, you know, this shouldn't just be speed to criminalization. They do have the right to a fair, you know, trial. And in some cases, that means time needs to be taken, because you need to depose witnesses. You need to, in the case of misdemeanors, it's a different set of circumstances. And that's really where I want us to focus, which is look at what the programs are that you need to administer to have the best outcomes. And then you build a facility around that, you know, quickly, you know, running to what are we building and then trying to shoehorn programs in to something that's already built is somewhat of what we're in today. And so we know, let's not go down that path. And so those that are looking at, I want to design the programs and then have the program director say, you know what, if I had this sort of facility, you know, this type of open space, this type of offices, you know, we even saw this when we built the domestic violence center, you know, that, you know, having the prosecutors in the, you know, the way people enter a space is different. You know, the victim shouldn't, you know, and where do the kids come, and, you know, where should the kids be while, you know, their parent is going through this. And so you really have to be, you know, really cognizant of how does this all work? What does it look like when, you know, this is a human business, and you need to understand the impact on the human.
We're talking with Spokane Mayor David Condon on the Inland Journal. Is this a case of we're going to do this, or we're just considering doing this? And is it tied to a new potential jail, or is this something that the city would consider separate and distinct from a jail?
Yes, yes, and yes. It's It's we are going down a path. We just chartered the what we call a project management charter, so it kind of talks about the different players. We need to get going down this path to see our public is demanding we take care of, especially property crime. And this is one of those avenues. After we have really looked on the enforcement side, now we look at the rehabilitation and the in the victim support. It is in conjunction with a with the planning of a high security jail. Not something that I'm against either. And similarly, work has to be done there. And then the third is that this is under the jurisdiction of the city, and we need to move these things forward. But it's done in a sense of collaboration, similarly the way that the city was a vital player in the development of Shrek. This is a service that all of us need, and we're better together than separate. But it is fully under the, misdemeanor crime is under the jurisdiction of cities. And in our case for us, and that's why several years ago the city decided to have a municipal bench. But at the end, I am looking for the outcome, which is rehabilitated people that are not re-victimizing my citizens, our citizens, in property crime. And so we want to do this together. And that, in my administration, you've seen that's exactly. We believe doing it together is better. It is integrated into the total criminal justice system. I do believe that a new facility is needed at the large side. I would hope that it would have similar parameters, meaning that we need to do it within current budget. It should be a systems approach and not just building a building for building's sake. But we do not at the city have the authority for that. That's a county level of authority. Would we want to be a participant? Absolutely. It's we share the same citizens. But that authority does rest with the county government.
So does the city's misdemeanor project go forward even after you step away as mayor?
Oh, absolutely. This is, not only part of, our strategic plan, One Spokane, Safer, Smarter, Healthier. Something like this hits all three of those broad, definitions of making us a safer community. When you look at rehabilitation, it makes us a healthier community, especially when you look at some of the root causes of the property crime. They're health-related, addiction, mental health, other issues that that have afflicted folks, opioid abuse. These are all health issues. And we want to do it in a smarter way. We want the governments to work together better. We want to use smart technology like texting. If you would have said we were texting the accused 4 or 5 years ago, people would have laughed. Even today, people are like, seriously? But we're finding that when we, someone gives us their cell phone number and they have a court date, it can become confusing. So if you get a text, hey, this morning, you have a court date at 10 o'clock. As we look at some of the reasons why some of these drag on for so long, it's missed court appearances. And so we're looking and using smarter technology. And so as you look at the One Spokane strategic plan, this is clearly in it. And we also at the city have implemented a project management office. And it sits right outside the mayor's office, right in between the mayor's office and the city council's office, led by a director that looks at all the projects that are going on. They're all chartered, meaning that we sit down, we discuss what the outcomes are, we look at who the key stakeholders are, we allocate budget and resources to it. And that's all managed. I review those projects on a quarterly basis. There is a project management steering committee that's made up by administration officials and two members of the city council, so that they can prioritize those projects, because in the city business, that project list could go on for miles, and we need to prioritize which ones are top. This is one of the top projects, so that means that resources and personnel are assigned to it because it's a top priority of our citizens.
Yeah. So that's a good way to get into infrastructure. Yeah. And as we look at Riverfront Park over there under construction, we look at the combined sewer overload system right outside of the city hall here. What do you say is the state of the city's infrastructure right now in terms of physical facilities?
Well, it's the envy of the country. I actually was invited to speak to a summit on infrastructure in Pittsburgh in later July. I sat as my time on the U.S. Conference of Mayors on the Transportation Committee, and just had a few comments actually during our meeting this summer, and received probably a half dozen requests, in particular for our link linked initiative, and this is where we've linked all of our infrastructure together and where we see so many benefits. And this is where we've linked road construction with wastewater, sewer construction, water construction. Now even our private utilities are aligning theirs. And so this is the envy of the country of how we've been able to do this. And so, yes, you mentioned our six-year project on combined sewer overflow will be coming to completion at the end of this year. Some will linger into next year as we will finalize that. But then also why I was very bullish on the school district and really my team, and next week the city council will be voting on transferring the lands for our new six middle schools. But right now the budget process at the city has become much more structured. The administration through the chief financial officer and then also a joint committee of the city council and in the administration and outside experts. Something started under the Jim West administration, an economic forecast committee. It'll be meeting, I believe, the second week of August, and we'll ratify our fiscal guidance. What does it look like next year? What does our tax revenue look like? What does the cost look like? And then right after that, the administration will publish our capital budget. The capital budget next year looks like it'll be about $219 million. Then just for the out years, the next year is $153 million. 2022 is $91 million. 2023 is $102 million. So you do see a decrease, and a lot of that is the completion of the combined sewer overflow program. But it still hovers right around $100 million, about half of what it has been. So that will be published at the later part of August, and then on the heels of that will be the program budget. This is the operating budget. So the police department, the fire department, and their operating budget, separate from their capital. But right now, as we speak in July, each one of the departments is coming in front of me. We have a 2 or 3 inch binder that shows every single project that is going on that makes up that some $219 million for next year, looking at all those projects. And so really the capital, our system is very, very advanced. And so it's kind of a three-step process. We do the fiscal guidance, then we do the capital budget, we do the program budget, and then the administration delivers their draft fund budget to the, or department-level budget to the city council. And that's when everybody starts talking. Latter part of October, beginning of November, and that's where the two of them come together, where next year's capital budget merges with next year's operational budget, and then the city council approves that before the end of the year. And that's where most of the people see the debate, but really it started well back in, you know, the spring of this year.
So where are the areas of that $219 million, are there specific areas that are going to get a lot of attention in terms of infrastructure next year?
Well, the big three, wastewater, still $72 million as we finish up the CSO program. The water program also at $31 million. So this is our water infrastructure. And actually above that is the street. $38 million going into our streets. These are some of the highest numbers that this community has ever seen. And that's why you see so much road construction, maybe even frustrating some of our citizens during the summer. But really where you've seen us get in our roads into good repair. And, you know, we've been piloting and now looks like maybe even putting into the system a more robust grind and overlay where you see us grinding 2 to 4 inches off the top. Lower Maple, you know, Cedar, that area has been getting done throughout the city. And that's where out of the $38 million is I do what we call the budget roadshow, the program budget. I'll be updating the public. I'll be doing outreaches in each one of the city council districts in September, early October. They'll see maps of where we are planning on doing road construction and road maintenance. They'll see those maps. And we'll start tweaking some of them. And that's where you see the city council asking, you know, why are you doing that road versus this road? And in some cases, we make those shifts. And that's why I do the budget roadshow. It's not finalized until December 31st. Now, we'll have justification of why we're doing those, but the citizens have the ability to give us feedback and say, you know what, we see you're doing this road, but this road is worse. In some cases, we're doing that road because back to our linked initiative, we're replacing, you know, a sewer or water main. And so rather than just patching it, we're doing a total reconstruct. And so that might be why we're doing that. But in other cases, we've changed. changed, and we've gone along with what the feedback from the citizens have said, and we go and redo some roads that weren't initially on our schedule. And that's why we do that feedback for a couple months and get that feedback from folks and show people on the maps. But still very robust. Like I said, we are, you know, in my interactions at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, we are the envy. It is interesting, though, because one of my first meetings, we were just going into the CSO program. You know, it was $500 million. And I was lamenting about the cost to our community. And at the time, it was Greg Ballard at Indianapolis. And he heard me lamenting in one of the meetings. And he said, you know, David, you need to really look what Indianapolis was doing. And so I wasn't able to go to Indianapolis, but Amber Waldriff went, Rick Romero went, and Teresa Sanders went. And that started where we really relooked the way we were doing the combined sewer overflow program, cutting some $150 million out of the cost and going to a much more green solution, much more infiltration in what we ended up doing. And so the idea came out of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and now fast forward 6 years, many of new mayors and even some of the other ones are really focusing on how did you do that? But the idea came out of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and now full circle, they're asking me to come back and present on how we did it. And I have to give it to the team here in the Spokane City Government and administration officials that I appointed, whether it be Rick Romero or Scott Simmons and others that have led our water department and our sewer department, and what we've been able to do is really the envy of the country now.
So you've just got back from another of your Conference of Mayor meetings. Is there anything you came back from Hawaii with that you say, well, we think we could do this here?
You know, absolutely. Really, one of the key areas we've been focusing on, and especially my attention, is job creation inside the city. You know, and now that we have spent so much on infrastructure, you know, how do we build out from that infrastructure? So at the city, we have an approach for economic development of targeted areas, and that is around the airport, around the university district, and around the extension of I-90, the north-south corridor. All of them have been roughly billion-dollar public investments. We have created public development authorities around those. Out in the West Plains, we did that with the county. Again, in my administration, I believe we're better partnering with our other governments. Unfortunately, in Northeast Spokane, the city council has not seen that to be a benefit. So the city is going to go out and do that one on our own. And then, of course, we have the same thing down at the university district. But at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, one of the federal tools is opportunity zones. And this is a tax advantage for those that are realizing capital gains. And so our opportunity zones are also mimicked in those same areas. But we've had fits and starts on how we utilize that tool. So I received a lot of information both out of the White House, the Director of Intergovernmental Affairs, and looking at opportunity zones. And not only that, but also private sector. And so we're bringing together some of the folks to how we make that happen. So that was one. The other is the launch of the Spokane Resource Center, a HUD-recognized Envision Center. I presented with the Aspen Institute, which is a national or international organization that facilitates all sorts of things across the United States. But really, how do we really utilize our partners in the Spokane Resource Center in the area of financial stability? And so the work with the Aspen Institute of really stabilizing some of our most vulnerable families financially and bringing them in. And so later in August, the Aspen Institute will be here. We'll be putting that together. It's part of the $1.7 million grant that the governor assigned to the Resource Center, and they're focusing on individuals and families that are receiving SNAP benefits, food stamp benefits. But how do we have other services? It's not only SNAP benefits people need. They need other services. It might mean how do they become part of the healthcare exchange? How do they get the benefit of maybe a housing voucher? And so how do we stabilize them financially? And that's really, so some of that work I saw at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and so I hope here in the next several months of my administration we can really solidify what that looks like at the Spokane Resource Center. What does it look to have a neighborhood, as we're calling them there, of financial resources to stabilize a family?
David Condon is the outgoing mayor of Spokane. If you missed part of this interview, you can hear it on today's podcast, available on Apple Podcasts, Google Plus, or NPR One. Our full interviews with the candidates who want to replace him are available for listening anytime on the Spokane Public Radio website. Click on the Regional News tab, and then on Election 2019, or go to the Inland Journal page. The ballots are due out any day. They must be returned either to a ballot drop box or to the county elections office, or by mail, postmarked, by August 6th. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Thank you for listening.